Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppence.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution with us. It's been a while, but it's also been a very interesting kind of period. We have been, as I said briefly last week, dashing around, but it doesn't seem like Revelations has stopped while we've been away.
Well, I know that you talked a little bit last week when I was not available about the Jesus' wife incident, but I think this is certainly something that is in my bailiwick, and I am getting lots of letters about, and we've been talking about it on Facebook, and I think it really bears some very, very serious discussion, especially in light of some other events that happened this weekend. So, for those of you who have been living in a cave and are not aware of the fact that in September, Karen King from Harvard Divinity School, who is also considered by most of us to be the preeminent Magdalene scholar in the world, at a conference in Rome unveiled an extraordinary piece of papyrus about the size of a business card. This scrap of papyrus, the scrap as we lovingly call it, has gained a lot of attention because of what this scrap actually says. And one of those things is it has Jesus referring to my wife. And Jesus said to them, quote, my wife, dot, dot, dot. So this has caused great explosions and lots of controversy about whether or not this is an authentic piece of papyrus. Where did it come from? What's the provenance? There are people screaming this is exciting. There are people screaming that it's a forgery. Lots and lots of things have happened here. It's been a little bit of a circus, and it continues to be. So one of the things I want to talk about here, first of all, is Karen King herself. Karen King is a very, very careful academic. She is not a sensationalist. She is not one to jump into the fray and wave something around and say, look what I found, for the publicity or for the sensationalism. She certainly isn't going to do this with something as controversial as a piece of papyrus that might refer to something as important as Jesus's wife. Now, let's talk about why for a minute. Karen King, over the last 10 years since the Da Vinci Code and my book and the resulting Magdalene madness, has been pretty strong in her point of view that there is no proof that Jesus was married. She is not a supporter of the Mary Jesus theory. She is not a supporter of the Magdalene as Jesus's wife theory. I think she's always really been more about helping us to understand that Mary Magdalene had an important role in Jesus's ministry, but never been one to want to take it to the next level. And this is a traditional academic posturing. Academics don't go to this place of progressive thought, nor do they factor in the things that people like us use, which are folklore, mythology, traditions, all these things that become part and parcel of the story. For me, the folklore, the oral traditions, the cultural traditions, even the architecture and the art of a particular culture, in most cases we're talking about the southwest of France, point to a story of Mary Magdalene that's very different than what is in the academic sources. Now, a Karen King, who is teaching at Harvard Divinity School, is not going to accept the folklore that I am immersed in for 20 years in the Languedoc region of France. She's just not going to do that. That's not her job. She's an academic. Her job is to take the acceptable academic sources and work from them. So one of the things I'm trying to say here is that this is a slippery slope for Karen King. On the one hand, someone hands her what might be the most important discovery in modern spirituality of the not just in the 21st century, maybe of any century. Incredibly important, potentially earth-shattering, could impact the belief system of 2 billion people if it can be proven to be real, authentic, etc. But you also have a woman here who has been extremely vocal and very strong in the last 6 to 10 years about saying that she doesn't believe that Jesus was married. So I can kind of imagine the conundrum she must have had being given this extraordinary find and then thinking, oh, gosh, what do I do now if this completely invalidates the stand that I have taken for the last 10 years?
Well, and it's definitely given her, I think, a good example of how it feels to be in the middle of controversy, and being attacked, and being attacked for even not taking a stand, because she's very hands off with this. It's almost like, oh well, yeah, you know, I have this thing, and I'm going to give a lecture about it. But she's non-committal. She is perfectly happy to say that you know, this isn't proof of anything. That she's only willing to consider the fact that this is indeed a genuine piece of material, but that the contents could mean anything, and that at best, you know, this is evidence of the fact that in the 4th century or thereabouts, people might have believed that Jesus was married. So she's not at all saying that, you know, Jesus was married, or that Mary Magdalene was one of his principal disciples. She's very non-committal about that, but she's found herself in such a storm of publicity that I actually thought, you know, and I kind of like hinted at that at last week's show, that the naysayers were going to get in there, and they were already coming in at the end of last week. But what seems to be happening is now, you know, I mean, well, over the weekend the Vatican said something, and all of a sudden the Vatican is quoted as the authority. It's almost kind of like going, okay, so the next headline is that we're going to hire, sorry, that we're going to interview the murderer, and we're going to say murderer says he didn't do it. It's fine. We should all let him get away with literally murder there.
Well, that's true, because that, I mean, asking the Vatican for their point of view on this item, which, by the way, they have not seen, they have not examined. To my understanding, the Vatican has seen no more of this than we have. They're looking at the pictures online and USA Today and everything else. I mean, you and I were in Rome, actually, at the time that this was unveiled, and it actually took a number of days before the Italian papers would even comment on it. And I think it's because they were all terrified to see where it was going to go and what the Vatican was going to say. But to your point, you know, asking the murderer for his opinion is really not a bad analogy for what's happening here. We cannot expect the Vatican to, in any way, shape, or form, ever, ever acknowledge that something like this is going to be important. And we're going to talk about why in a minute. But I want to back up and say, on the one hand, I think there's a little bit of karma here for Karen King. Now she sees, you know, what happens when you do try to be progressive about your point of view. And as someone who has been the naysayer and the academic who has sort of defeated people like me in the past, I'm kind of, you know, seeing her in the place of having to defend her point of view is interesting. And I think that maybe she earned that place. But on the other hand, I also do find her wishy-washy in that very academic way. There is a video on the Harvard Divinity School blog, their website, which shows her talking about this. And it is an amazing thing to witness the double speak. And it's a disappointing thing for me, because I want to support this woman so much, because she is, you know, she is doing something with it. But on the other hand, is she doing anything that's really terribly brave? Not really. She's pursuing her academic path, and she's, as you said, she's not really standing up for it. She's kind of backed off of it. She's just saying, okay, we'll do some more studies. Now, two things. First, before she announced that she had this fragment, she did significant amounts of background and digging. So even though we don't know everything about the provenance of the piece, a lot of people are screaming, "Oh, the provenance is fishy. No one knows where it came from." So we have to imagine that it's a forgery. Well, it's not entirely true. We don't know where it came from, but ostensibly she does. And there is a backstory behind how she got it and who gave it to her, and why that person is trying at the moment to remain secretive about it, because he doesn't want to be caught in the firestorm, et cetera, et cetera. At this point, I am inclined to take someone of Karen King's authority and reputation at her word when she says she knows where this came from and what the background information is. So I think that we can do that. But go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, It's not like she doesn't know the provenance of this story. The only thing which she refuses to say at this moment in time is the name of the person or the consortium or whoever it is who is owning this. And that is completely different from not knowing where it comes from. So she knows where it's come from. She knows who owns it. That is all fine and well. And actually, one of the things which and we'll come to this later, but this is actually like the first of a number of topics to do with like bad science, like where the science stops and mudslinging happens. The fact that the name of a person who owns a piece is not given out doesn't have anything to do with the scientific value of that piece or not. Yet you can see them all scrambling for the headline. The absolutely no important scientist, doctor whatsoever, who sees this opportunity to scream extremely loudly and say, "But I tell you, it is bad science." And it's kind of like, no, it's not. It is absolutely not. But it is, like this case has got so much bad science written all over it. But we'll come back to that later. But this is definitely one of them, whereby, again, they're going for the soft kind of kill the messenger approach.
Well, and oh, they are absolutely killing the messenger, and therefore the messenger is really backing off. And so the messenger is really not strong enough to handle this message. But on the other hand, because she isn't strong enough, maybe ultimately when this is proven to be authentic, it will carry more weight because she has never been a proponent. She's of this theory. She has never been one to stand up and say, "This is how I feel, and now I can prove it." I mean, if I had come forward with this fragment, the whole world would be against me and say, "Yeah, of course you did." So they would accuse me of making it in my backyard. But if you look at this video on the Harvard Divinity School blog where Karen talks about it, it's the most baffling thing I have ever seen. I watched it several times and I thought, I wonder if she hears herself, if she watches us herself and realizes how absolutely mad she sounds when she starts reading, "And Jesus said, my wife," and then goes on this entire diatribe about how this has absolutely nothing to do with Jesus being married. This doesn't mean that Jesus wasn't married. This doesn't mean anything. There's no evidence here. It's like kind of being in an alternate universe when I listen to how these academics double speak around this stuff. Here's the thing. This gospel text, wherever it comes from, does not say Jesus and his wife went up the mountain. It doesn't say, "And there was Jesus and his wife." It says, "And Jesus said unto them," quote, "my wife." That's pretty explicit. Now, what we're seeing here is that this is a Coptic fragment, right? Karen believes it was written sometime in the 4th century, but she also believes that it's based on something from about the year 200, so early 3rd century or late 2nd century. Which is in keeping with a lot of the Gnostic information that came out of Egypt. So when we look at the Coptic text, this all makes a lot of sense. So what everyone is saying now is, well, it just proves that there was some kind of a debate happening at that period of time about whether or not Jesus is married. And this appears to be the safe ground. See, this is where everyone can go and say, oh, even if it's proven authentic, we found a little safe island. Well, let's all come to this conclusion together. It's kind of like the conspiracy of academics, at the risk of sounding conspiratorial. But let's all agree on something that we can all deal with and hide behind if this is proven to be authentic. Because if it actually says Jesus is married and actually proves that Jesus is married, we're all kind of in a lot of trouble and we all look like idiots. It's sort of like what happens in Egypt with your dear friend Dr. Zahi Hawass and all of the other Egyptologists who have for such a long time been screaming about the dates of things and manufacturing Egyptology. It's the same thing. They're never going to accept something like the Bosnian pyramids being real. They're never going to accept something that proves all of their work to be incorrect. So what we're dealing with really is academic ego over the truth. And I think we're always going to deal with that, and I don't think that's ever going to change.
Well, no, and I actually think it will change, and we'll come back to that later. But yes, kind of like, there was some discussion about the fact whether or not Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married in the first few centuries after Christ, until the Council of Nicaea and various other things said no, and it was an absolute majority of the people who believed they were, and the minority perspective won there, and part of the reason why I often think that Mary Magdalene became the sinner, why she was taken, was because that notion of Mary Magdalene being important didn't go away. And as people know who've been reading my blog, but also I was working on Chinese pyramids, and I was reading a book called The Terracotta Army, and it's about the first emperor of China, and he basically had an advisor who wrote about the five venoms, and one of them was actually people being able to access historical records and quote from times past and say how much better it was, and he just felt that was abhorrent, and it made his life miserable, so he couldn't help the emperor in controlling the people as much as he wanted to. But the point of that is that really what he was saying there was that it's, you can do two things. One of them is extract the record, like make somebody disappear. But he
Right.
said actually it's far
Like they did in
cleverer.
ancient Egypt, right?
Sorry?
Like they did in ancient Egypt. You struck people from the records. You got rid of their name, and therefore they didn't exist in history anymore.
Communism with photographs of people who, allegedly never were at a meeting. Or IKEA photographs of women not looking in their mirrors in Saudi Arabia, apparently. All of these things of photoshopping and excising them from the record is something which, was proposed. However, a few decades later, somebody more clever came around and actually thought, actually, it's better to keep them in the record, but edit it. Make the truth, something else. And that, I think, is what happened to Mary Magdalene. On a number of occasions, a minor character you can just remove from the record. You won't notice, but somebody who is important, you cannot remove them from the record. You have to deal with it. So what you do is you change it, and I think this is basically what the church did. The church realized that Mary Magdalene was extremely important. There was an enormous devotion to Mary Magdalene everywhere, because for 2, 3 centuries she had been as important and the continuation of the Christian religion. And what seems to have happened is that they, by focusing on the original sin, all of a sudden they could say, oh well, Jesus loved her so much because she was a whore, she was a great sinner, and people continued to identify with her. The devotion to Mary Magdalene remained, and the church could pretend everything was fine because now they were worshipping her because she was a great sinner. And I think this creation of her as a sinner goes back to the fact that she couldn't be excised from the record. They had to deal with her. They had to do something with her. And we're beginning to see, I think, with this piece of material that, after years of the church being in control of Nag Hammadi, the Dead Sea Scrolls, clearly this piece of information got away from them. It got into the hands of somebody who took different roads, maybe because, again, he or she, whoever has ownership of this, realized that whatever they had, they wanted to have an as fair, or at least a step at a fair treatment of this piece of material in the general public discussion forums.
Well, going back first of all to what you were just saying about Mary Magdalene being, deliberately recast in what happened in the first century drama, of course we know that that's absolutely correct because the church admits it. The church even says that they did that. They admit to doing it, and they claim that they did it because they wanted to create an icon of repentance that everyone could deal with. So infamously, in the Easter homily of 599, Pope Gregory the Great makes this statement where he conflates Mary Magdalene with the unnamed sinner in Luke's gospel. And he puts these stories of these three women together and sort of lumps Mary Magdalene into this unclean sinner story and creates the poster girl for repentance. So if this dirty whore, fallen sinner, can be redeemed by Jesus, and she's as low as this, because certainly at this stage in history, there is nothing lower than being a dirty whore. So if this dirty whore can be redeemed by Jesus, then so can you. And this is the role that they cast her in, and this is the place that she has stayed. And to your point, they had to do something because she was getting too big. So in sullying her name, they kind of take some of the air out of this extremely powerful movement that is happening. And replace it with, well, see, she really was a dirty sinner. And the only reason she matters is because Jesus redeemed her. So they've disempowered her, haven't they? They've taken her power away. And they have done what they wanted to do, which was created an icon of repentance, but also made Jesus the sole power holder here, because he redeems her. And she is nothing until he redeems her.
But one of the things that I really want to talk about, which I think that everyone is missing, and I think that this is actually, for me, the epitome of why this is such an important little piece of papyrus. It's not even the, quote, my wife controversy. It's something even bigger than that, I think. And that is, when you look at what has been identified in this papyrus, what it actually says, the my wife piece of it is only a part of it, important part, but there's a lot going on here with this particular amazing little, you know, 3-inch by 4-inch piece of paper. And if you look at it, the opening sentence that we see on the papyrus, and of course the rest of it is lost, we don't know what preceded it, we don't know what follows it, and all that's very frustrating. It's not uncommon practice, unfortunately, in the world of black market antiquities to cut papyruses all up like this, because you make more money if you sell them this way. So unfortunately, we may never know what it says before or after it, but then again, maybe fortunately we will. Maybe the rest of these fragments will come to light at some point. But what we have is so important, because it opens with Jesus praising his mother. The opening sentence that we have on this fragment says, "My mother gave me life." And then we have a series of other little words and fragments. The word deny is in the sentence right before he also says, "Mary is worthy." So again, we don't really know what it says, but it could be that he is telling his male disciples, don't deny Mary's worthiness here. And then Jesus says unto them, "My wife." And then it says, "I dwell with her in order to." Now, for me, this is the real juice of this fragment. I dwell with her in order to. You know, oh gosh, do I wish we had the rest of that sentence. But on the other hand, it's quite a tantalizing thing to imagine what it could possibly say. We actually had a lot of fun on Facebook with this. We played this kind of fill-in-the-blanks game. But beyond, you know, where this could take us in sort of our fantasy world of wanting it to say something that, you know, is the smoking gun of Jesus and Mary's relationship, I think what happens is we have to take all of these pieces together and then go to that final sentence that says Mary would be a disciple. So now what we have is Jesus celebrating that his mother gave him life, asking people not to deny something, and following it with a sentence about Mary's worthiness. We have him saying, "My wife," and then we have him saying, "I dwell with her in order to," and then we have him saying, "She would be a disciple." I mean, this is an incredibly important little tiny fragment in terms of putting all these things together, and I think it's not merely, and I use that word loosely because there's nothing mere about this, but it's not merely the papyrus of Jesus's wife. I think this is the papyrus of Jesus celebrating the importance of women in his ministry. And that is what I think is truly important about this. And that is also what I think is absolutely terrifying for the Vatican. Because now we're talking about something that gives authority to women in Jesus' ministry. And the one defense that they have had all along is women cannot be ordained because Jesus did not have any female disciples. And so all of a sudden, if we have a Jesus who is talking about the importance of women, the power of women, and proclaiming that Mary Magdalene will be and is a disciple, then all of a sudden this knocks the Vatican off of its foundations.
Absolutely, and I think it's the double whammy effect, which really is the reason why the church goes so much after this. It's not to do, you know, the church will survive quite easily whether or not Jesus is married. In this day and age, that's not that controversial. But the fact that there were women disciples at a time when the Vatican is saying, no, there never were. This is like, you know, sacrosanct. They are even, you know, sending almost death notices to nuns and other women in America who are doing good, and whereas they should be focusing on things like abortion and those kind of things. That is really the killer for the church, because that is like, I mean, it's a good cancer because it's going to eat away crap within the church, but it is a cancer which can destroy the church, because it is what the opposition has been looking for, of basically saying, women should be allowed to do that. And obviously, it's a debate which the church also has with different denominations, specifically the Church of England, which allows women to be ordained and to lead services, and which continues to be one of the big problems between those two. Even though they want to reunite, they kind of like are absolutely against this possibility of women taking on a role within the Christian world, the Christian everyday community. And I think that is really the big stumbling block for the church, and also why they came out, with such a vengeance over the weekend against this.
Well, the church has really doubled down on their anti-women stance in the last year, and this is certainly the work of Benedict XVI, who is no friend to females. First of all, sometime in the last year, he made this horrible, horrible statement that ordaining women is in the same category of sin as pedophilia. And that, for me, and I think many others, was pretty earth-shattering. It's this idea that to ordain a woman is a sin as great as abusing a child in the most horrific way. That's something that I think that the rest of us who live outside of the Vatican and live in the real world, that's a place that we can't even go to in our heads. And it's a place that we shouldn't have to, because it is not a position of the 21st century. It's an obscenity, actually.
I was actually going to say, I don't think anybody should go there. I actually think it should be made illegal to go there.
Yeah, it's an absolute obscenity. And I think that it's important that more and more people are aware of this. And I'm paraphrasing, but what I will do is I will pull up the actual quote, because I'm asked for it all the time. And I'm going to do a blog post on this. So I will put this up on my blog, which is legendsofthedivinefeminine.com, sometime this week. I'm going to write kind of an analysis of what we're talking about here today to give some information, because I also want to cite a number of scholarly sources. One of the things I ultimately want to do is send people who are really interested in this to some of these sources that exist that are in support of this papyrus, because what's happening now is, in this time with the Vatican, as I said, doubling down anti-women, you mentioned the controversy here in America against the nuns. Well, for those who are not familiar with it, nuns in the U.S. right now are under fire by the Vatican, who is coming out and saying the nuns here are spending too much time working with the poor and the hungry when they should be instead spending their time working against abortion. And of course, the nuns are coming back and saying, that's not what we're here to do. We took vows that we could help the poor, so that we could, you know, walk in the footsteps of those who've come before us who were extremely devoted to the poor. Some of these women are Franciscans, they're in the Poor Clares Order, and they're really, really devoted to dealing with the poor. And they did not take this vocation because they wanted to be anti-abortion crusaders. And what's happening is they're dealing with all kinds of threats. Become a real major crisis for the church, and certainly brings into focus this idea that women are just not respected. Even women who have dedicated their entire life to service to the church are not getting any kind of support or respect for the fact that they are doing exactly as Jesus instructed them to do. They are having absolute integrity in their vocation to help the poor. So what we've seen in the last year is a sort of attack on women, including women in their own orders in the church. So we have to understand that anything that comes out now that supports the role of women in spirituality from Jesus' own voice is going to be absolutely terrifying to the church. And let's be honest, if it was the 13th century, there would already be a crusade against us, and we would already be burning people at the stake.
Well, it happened at a time, of course, where the Vatican has come under tremendous pressure, because this weekend was actually when, inside the Vatican, one of the very close people around the Pope went on trial. He basically took documents on a number of occasions, apparently, from the Pope's desk and gave them to a very leading investigative journalist in Italy. This happened early this year, as far as we're aware. I mean, the arrest definitely happened early this year. The book which the person was giving the information for was published in Italian in April. The researcher involved is, as I said, a leading investigative journalist. He deals with such thing as the mafia. He has basically been writing books about how a new type of mafia and new mafia families are making their way through the Italian layers of politics. This man, you know, who took these papers, was going on trial on Saturday morning in the Vatican. There were no cameras allowed whatsoever. It is clear that as much as they could, nine journalists apparently were allowed, and there was allegedly a drawn a lottery kind of mechanism to get these people there. They had to share everything they had. They had to share photographs. They had to share information. But it is clear that this was a case where it went extremely, extremely dangerously close to some of the inner secrets of the Vatican, which this person, Gabriele, wanted to bring out. This person has also been exposing some of the more intriguing aspects of paedophilia, but also various aspects of what has been going on within the heart of the church. And so in one weekend, or in 2 weeks, you had two attacks. One of them is very political. It's a high-profile case. As much as the media is not reporting on it, it is an extremely important case. The other one is that they were being attacked indirectly by Jesus Christ, almost from the grave, by this document, which basically says that, you know, women should be allowed to participate within the Christian community on an everyday basis. So it are, you know, I think the reason why they went so vociferous with this over the weekend was almost primarily due to the fact that they wanted to make sure that some of the attention was deflated away from what was happening in the Vatican. And I think in a number of instances they succeeded in that, specifically in the written press.
Oh, very, very definitely. Now, here's what people need to understand, because this is really what is incredibly important when we talk about the truth against the world. You know, that is our motto, the truth against the world, and this is really the crux of the situation. So what happens is the Vatican jumps in with both feet and says, this gospel fragment is a forgery. And they say terrible things. It's a clumsy fake. They cast aspersions on Karen King. You know, they quote much lesser scholars than the ones who have already said that it is potentially authentic, and in some cases some have actually said that it is authentic. They quote scholars who are less reputable and have much lesser reputations as saying basically whatever the Vatican wants them to say, which is, oh, of course it's a clumsy fake, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as I said, this is without any kind of analysis. This is strictly the Vatican having a massive PR campaign to say it's a fake. But here is why this works. The Vatican has a much bigger budget for PR than most of us. And so what happens is it's now trumpeted across everything. Vatican says it's a fake. It's a fake. It's a clumsy fake. Vatican says it's a fake. Right now, if you pull up all the Yahoo News and the Google News and all that stuff, what you're going to see over and over again is the Vatican says it's a fake. Now, the thing about this that is so outrageous is when you start looking at the anatomy of this, and this is why I want to get it online so people are seeing some of these some of this backup material that I want to provide for them. And I need to give a shout out to to James Tabor, because it was through his blog and his academic website that he sources a number of these incredibly powerful academic accounts of why this is potentially authentic and why it is outrageous that these scholars are coming out with no analysis whatsoever to say that it's a fake. And Tabor lists a lot of amazing sources, and it's quite academic, some of these sources, and they're a little bit difficult to get through. So what I have done is I have sorted through them and kind of put it in layman's terms so that people can understand what the sources are. But the bottom line is this. Karen King, before she made this announcement, went to the most revered authorities in things like papyrus and Coptic grammar. By the way, she's an expert in Coptic, in this Coptic translation herself, so she deserves credit for this as well. But she went to top-notch experts and got them to sign off on the power of this piece before she went public with it. She was incredibly diligent about doing this. Her paper, which you can read online, the first draft of her paper anyway, that is they're preparing to publish, we think, in January in Harvard, the Harvard Theological Review, is incredibly careful. She really deserves, I believe, to be given, you know, credit for how careful she has been and that she has followed all the academic protocol. And people need to back off and stop calling her names and let her do her academic research. But unfortunately, what happens is the average person on the street reads the USA Today headline or the banner that comes across on Google or Yahoo or AOL and says, oh, look, Vatican says it's a fake. See, told ya. And then everyone makes fun of it and says, oh, that thing, it's a fake, and it's over. And it's kind of like, you know, their attraction will ultimately print it on page 45 in 8 font type saying, oh, guess what, it's not a fake, and all those people were lying, paid off, or trying to make a name for themselves. And no one will care because all the masses are seeing is, oh, Vatican says it's a fake. This goes back to your original analogy earlier. It's like asking the murderer if he's innocent. The murderer says he's innocent. Oh, then he must be innocent. It's the same thing.
Absolutely. And I think James Tabor was actually making another interesting point, which was that almost, I actually think, exactly a decade ago, you had the so-called James ossuary, which at that moment in time was extremely controversial. It talked about the brother of Jesus. It gave further details, which kind of like seemed to indicate that this was indeed Jesus Christ, as opposed to any other Jesus running around in Jerusalem. And I think if we were to do a poll, most people who will have heard of this will think it's a fake or that it's actually controversial. And Tabor is pointing out that, you know, that this has been done via the police, this has been done via academics. There is no proof whatsoever that this is fake. Everything which they've investigated suggests this is absolutely authentic. They have actually found more evidence to suggest that this is authentic since the year 2002. But mud sticks. You know, Lee Harvey Oswald will always be the sole assassin in the Kennedy assassination. In 1978 or 9, the House Select Committee on Assassinations actually publicly declared that Kennedy was killed as part of a conspiracy involving at least two gunmen. Everybody still goes on about the Warren Commission and how Oswald is the lone assassin. There is something there to it. You know, Mary Magdalene is still the whore. There's something to it that mud sticks, and this is why mud is being flung. And you know what the Vatican did over the weekend was make sure, I think even to a point, that if you were to do a Google search just on Vatican, you would go to the Jesus material rather than you go to the court case which is going on in the Vatican.
Well, one of the things that Tabor's blog does brilliantly is, one, he's very concise. He's wonderful to read because he makes his point. He makes it concisely. He's an academic who actually knows how to talk to the masses. And this is one of the things that I really admire about James Tabor, is that he's able to walk that line. He is an academic. He's a professor. He is teaching in North Carolina. But at the same time, he's really able to talk to the rest of us in the real world as non-academics and really make his point, and he's really gifted at that. But what he does in his blog, and I believe it's at jamestabor.com if you want to take a look at it, but I will also note it in my blog as well, is he then annotates everything. He talks about the anatomy of this whole process with the papyrus being fake. And because he is an academic and because he lives in that academic world, and to your point, because he was attacked over this whole idea of the James Ossuary and the Talpiot tomb, you know, he really knows how this works. And so he's very careful about giving you all the sources. And there's one thing, and it's a little bit detailed, so I'm not going to go into it too much, but I will write about this week for those of you who want to see it. He shows you the anatomy of how these skeptics work. And it's really fascinating. There is an incredible article online that you can find through Tabor's blog done by a scholar in Helsinki in Finland. And what the scholar does is he takes one of these skeptics and he says, okay, the skeptic is saying that the text is not authentic for the following reasons. And he takes it apart and shows you how the skeptic takes that reasoning and turns it into a theory. But what happens as you watch it is you see how much these, quote, scholarly skeptics actually have to change the evidence to make their case. So, for example, in our papyrus scrap, there is a really interesting phrase at the end of it that says, Jesus says that, may the wicked swell up. And this phraseology, this wording of swell up is unusual. It doesn't occur anywhere else, which is very interesting because it's one of the things that speaks to the authenticity of this piece. So even though the naysayers and the Vatican hires are saying, oh, well, this resembles too much the Gospel of Thomas, so it's just a copy of this. It's not really authentic. You know, this is how we know it's a forgery. Well, they have a problem because this little tiny fragment, it's only 3 by 4 inches, has two phrases in it that have never occurred and that they can't account for. And one of those phrases is my wife. And by the way, that cannot be interpreted any other way, and everyone agrees on that. And the other one is this phrase, may the wicked swell up. So it's problematic for them because they can't say, oh, see, we have this here or here or here. It was copied from this, and this is what the forgers were copying from because they don't exist. So what happens is these skeptical scholars who are being paid to prove that this is not authentic are actually changing the translation of these words so that it does fit into something that they can say. So instead of let the wicked swell up, he translates it to something like let the wicked bring it forth, which is a completely different meaning. But by taking that, he can then say, see, this is from the copy from the Gospel of Thomas, therefore forgery. So when you start digging into all these people who are making a name for themselves, this particular skeptic's name is Francis Watson, and I think that there's a very special place in Dante's hell for skeptics like this. And this is what he does. He takes this information, he turns it and twists it and shoehorns it so that he can make a case against something that really is not a case at all because there's nothing authentic about the way that he's doing the interpretation. So it's manipulative, it's dishonest. I think it's criminal.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it's whether it is in Egypt, whether it is, you know, Eric von Daniken in Odyssey of the Gods talks about at one point about the Golden Fleece, Jason and the Argonauts and the Golden Fleece. And he points out that in the beginning of the 19th century, I believe it was a German guy who basically was reading Jason and the Argonauts and kind of like felt that somehow what Jason was looking for didn't make sense because it was something which would fly and which was under control. And he didn't understand what that was. So he basically substituted that word with wool. Because wool was something which everybody understood, and because he didn't understand what it was, you know, for the past 200 years, we have been reading incorrect translations. And what Eric kind of does with this example is he goes through all the ways, you know, words have constantly been mistranslated, and it happens on so many occasions. You know, it happens in daily life. Remember a few years ago how the CIA did a translation of an alleged Osama bin Laden speech, whereby according to the CIA and the State Department under Bush, this was what bin Laden said. Every other Arab speaker in the world, however, said this was not the case, that Osama bin Laden had said something completely differently. But guess what? You know, for public consumption in America, it works, because they are going to listen to the State Department's translators, the voice of authority, who has just mistranslated something absolutely deliberately on purpose. But it works because of the way this game is being played. Fortunately, I think, you know, The game of science is becoming less and less important. It really is being pushed into an ivory tower, and you can see how they are struggling. You know, on the media, they're surviving because it's part of the same clique. They still play with the rules which the scientists like to play with, but everywhere else, it's an open field, and you can see how the likes of James Tabor are bypassing pretty much the old ways of playing, and basically goes to his blog. And it's something which I have seen NASA do when it comes to astrobiology. I find that decent scientists, people who really mean well, who are so fed up of the games and the infighting and all of the stupidity which is being played, they go to the masses because they also know that they actually can make themselves understandable. They also know that the masses generally care, and that the masses don't care just about the academic infighting, which is all about ego and not about the information. So there are people like James Tabor who are actually making an extremely big contribution by doing what they're doing, and having the capabilities in doing what they're doing, i.e. make themselves understandable and point out you know, what truly is going on, and at the same time exposing the shenanigans of the universities, and also exposing some of, you know, the people and the names of the people involved in who are playing this game, either for ego purposes or for, as you say, hired purposes.
Well, I applaud Tabor's courage because I wish that Karen King had a fraction of that courage to stand up for what this fragment might actually mean. I'm afraid that her academic spinelessness might ultimately turn out to be damaging. Or, as I said before, maybe it is for the best because she doesn't have a pet agenda or a pet theory. Maybe that it will appear more authentic if someone like her is the one who brings it forth. We, you know, that all deserves to be seen, and we need to wait and let it happen and play out without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And on that subject, what happened this weekend is there was supposed to be on September 30th a documentary aired on the Smithsonian Channel called The Gospel of Jesus' Wife, and it was a one-hour piece on this discovery and what's known about it thus far. And the Smithsonian had been advertising it for about a week, and then all of a sudden, it disappeared. And all of a sudden, if you went to the Smithsonian Channel or you clicked on it, it said that it would not be airing at this time. There are no plans to air it at this time. And we have since been told that they have pulled it because of the growing doubts around the authenticity of the papyrus. And this is where the Vatican damage happens. So the fact that the Vatican comes out and says, it's a clumsy fake, it's a forgery, even though they have no proof whatsoever, and any of the scholars that they have saying this are lesser than those who have come out in favor of it, this is what everyone remembers. And so now today, by the way, there's headlines everywhere. It's on Yahoo News, and it was on another Google thing that was sent to me. You know, a documentary pulled under increasing doubts about the authenticity of the papyrus. But the only place where the increasing doubts are is in the media, because they're listening to the crap that is being handed out by the Vatican, which is propaganda, misinformation, and lies.
Well, and I would also like to point out it's the Smithsonian. I'm pretty actually sure, wild conspiracy theories here, but I'm pretty sure the Smithsonian bought this so that they could then pull it to basically, in an effort to exposing it. I'm sorry to say, but the Smithsonian continues to provide me with all the evidence I need to condemn them of being involved of destroying history and proposing, a fake perspective of history. It's like normally the investigative journalist has to investigate and come up with the evidence, but the Smithsonian really is doing it all by themselves and handing out the information all by themselves, which is, great. It makes life very easy. So, congratulations, Smithsonian. Keep doing it.
But unfortunately, this is what the American masses, they hear, oh, well, the Smithsonian, it must be legitimate. It's the Smithsonian. We all think the Smithsonian is this great bastion of the truth and the preservation of history and all of this stuff. And the average person isn't aware of just how insidious the Smithsonian is, of how many things they've tried to discredit, of how much the Smithsonian has impacted and interfered with any kind of progressive history. Most Americans certainly don't know that. So it's very damaging for people like us when these headlines get out saying, well, the Smithsonian pulled it because the increasing doubts, they couldn't be seen to be backing something that's a forgery. And there we are, again, front page headlines. This is what everyone remembers.
Yes, and I think it's an unfortunate step to go through. It's kind of like, it's unfortunate that these things still happen, but at one point the cookie will crumble. And I mean, I want to go into something else, which is that I'm here in Scotland, and they threw a copy of Nexus New Times, the latest issue, through, and it had an article by Professor Peter Phillips, who is a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University, California, and president of the Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored. Now, some of our people might know about Project Censored. It's basically each year they have a top 20, I think, of the news stories which should have made frontline news but never made it, basically because they were censored. So they do their contributing material in exposing this. But as I said, Peter Phillips is a professor, and he got fed up, it seems to me, with the conspiracy people constantly pointing out to the 1% and talking about them as Illuminati and they, and he has gone in search of them and has basically named and identified them. And it's actually one of the most interesting articles I have read in a conspiracy kind of thing in a long time. And before I come to the main point, which I absolutely like and adore as to what he wrote, I just want to kind of like, give some interesting aspects which he starts talking about along the way. First of all, the top 1% across the world is anybody who has more money than $588,000. And that is because, unfortunately, 2.5 billion in this world live on less than $2 a day. And that, unfortunately, is why it's quite easy in the Western world to come to the top 1%. Now, he basically at one point says, so, okay, we get the fact that you've identified the top 1%, but actually, you're probably meaning that it's an even lesser percentage than that. And so I am looking for a very interesting number, because he did the numbers even further. He starts quoting a guy who is David Robkoff. And David Robkoff is a former managing director of Kissinger Associates and deputy undersecretary of commerce for international trade and policy development. He wrote a book in 2008 called Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. And the professor is quoting, or writing, and I'm quoting him rather. According to Rotkopf, the superclass constitutes approximately 0.0001% of the world's population and is comprised of between 6,000 and 7,000 people. They control pretty much everything in this world. They basically are, incredibly rich. They, when he starts identifying them, you see assets of some of these companies they are in charge of. A small company only can kind of like contribute $807 billion in assets. There are companies listed in here who have 2.7 trillion in assets. And he points out how they all work together. He basically points out how they all meet in the same forums. They're all part of the same structure. And he identifies two companies. One of them is Freeport-McMoRan, the world's largest extractor of copper and gold. Reported revenues of $19 billion per year and a net income of $5 billion. They basically had the Indonesian miners go on strike last year, and he points out how Obama and the US Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta flew out to Indonesia to basically make sure that these people went back to work, even though they are exploited beyond anybody's belief. He also points out to another company called BlackRock, which is an investment company, basically the world's largest asset management firm, over 10,000 employees in more than 27 countries. As of March 2012, BlackRock manages assets worth $3.68 trillion in equity, fixed income, and all the rest. They have holdings in Chevron, Goldman Sachs, Exxon, all of these things. He basically names names of companies. He names names of the people involved. And he actually points out that there are very few people involved in this money scheme. So I kind of thought, okay, so this is all kind of doom and gloom until the final paragraph. Because remember, he starts doing this because he's fed up with conspiracy people just reporting about these people as the 1%. And this is his final paragraph. The Occupy movement uses the 1% versus 99% mantra as a master concept in its demonstrations, disruptions, and challenges to the practices of the transnational corporate class, within which the global superclass is a key element in the implementation of a super elite agenda for permanent war and total social control. Pretty grim, isn't it? Well, Occupy is exactly what the superclass fears the most. A global democratic movement that exports their agenda and the continuing theater of government elections, wherein the actors may change, but the marquee remains the same. The more that Occupy refuses to cooperate with their agenda and mobilizes activists, the more likely the whole system of dominance will fall to its knees under the people power of democratic movements. Basically, I was so enjoyed by this article because it underlines something which I always give the example of the Belgian Revolution. 250 rebellion Belgians broke Belgium away from the Dutch. Basically, Professor Peter Phillips has named, to some extent, shamed some of the people involved, and he's basically pointing out that at the end of the day, by basically, these Indonesian strikers to refuse to go to work, they stopped this company from doing certain things. The only ex reason why they went back to work was because America was applying pressure, and nobody in America seemed to know that this was going on. However, if, for example, and I'm making up scenarios here, if people in America were to stop doing these kind of things and say, well, today we're not going to work because of this, basically doing things in an organized way, if people do things in organized ways, anything can fall, anything can become exposed. Because at the end of the day, we are part of this system. It's part of the exploitation system, the exploiter, the person who is the exploitee, I guess the word there is actually part of the system. And when that person says enough is enough, then the system comes down as well. And that is basically what Professor Peter Phillips, in far more scholarly wording than I'm just doing here, is saying. So I was very happy with a professor who actually named them, gave some interesting examples. examples. And the article, even though it's on Nexus, it's also online on the website, and we will put it on our website if people want to read it in detail. And with that, we have come to the end of our show. If you want to listen to this one again, you can do so in a number of ways. There's iTunes. There is also thespiritrevolution.com. We will be back next week with more news, and we'll keep you posted on this news. But until then, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.